Talk Cheese.
Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we try to talk about issues in electronic discovery that are sometimes complicated with experts around the country to get this information out to people at a price people can afford, which is free, and at the time when they have the time to listen to the material. So today we've got a really great show. I'm pleased to say that Jonathan Redgrave is on the show with us today, and Jonathan has a really eclectic and interesting background. He's been involved with large law firms and virtual law firms that have influenced the whole field of e-discovery. He's been extremely involved with the Sedona Conference, both as a member of the advisory board. He's a member and he's a chair emeritus of the Sedona Conference right now for Working Group 1 on electronic document retention and production. He was the chair from 2002 to 2007 and chair emeritus 2007 onward. Member of Sedona Conference Working Group 6 on International Electronic Information Management. Member of the Sedona Conference Working Group 7 on Canada. Also member of the Advisory Committee in the Electronic Records Archives, Advisory Board at Georgetown University Law Center's eDiscovery Institute, and co-chair there, and on and on and on, with many publications that are very influential. And Jonathan, thank you for coming on the show with us today to talk about the role of special masters in electronic discovery.
Thanks, Carl. Very glad to be here.
Before we jump into that, you know, a question I always like to know is, how did you get involved in this new field of the last 10 years or so, electronically stored information?
Well, I guess for better or for worse, it goes all the way back into high school and my exposure to personal computing with the old Osborne. If anyone remembers that, you've been around for a little bit of time. It looked like an old fishing oscilloscope, and it was portable at the weight of about 15 pounds. I had one of the first Macintoshes in college and very involved in the use of computers in law school. I worked at the Center for Computer-Assisted Legal Instruction. And all throughout my practice, I kind of had an involvement with the use of computers in trial practice and then had the opportunity to start putting that to use, counseling clients with respect to records retention, discovery obligations, especially in the late 1990s, involved a lot in tobacco litigation. And then I just kind of mushroomed from there and got very involved in the beginning of this decade that culminated in getting people together to form the Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Document Production and Retention, Working Group 1, which went from the initial list of about 35 people to a membership list of over 800 people today. It's been a great opportunity for me to help people get into this area and see it from its many faceted approaches. And what I mean by that is this area is not just the province of lawyers. You've got people who are experts in records management. You've got people who are experts in the technical fields. Then you've also got lawyers who really get into and understand the implications, the legal implications for this area. And the great thing about Sedona and other groups and conferences like Georgetown is bringing people from these different disciplines together to think about some of the knotty problems that are in front of us, especially when you consider the neat and unfolding technologies we see, whether it's looking at collaborative spaces, Twitters, you name it. Every day, every month, we seem to have a new technology, and that's what's kind of fun about this area. It kind of keeps you fresh and gives you new challenges. So I've been involved in this area, Carl, for a long time. Expect to continue doing that.
And you mentioned Sedona. We're going to have Richard Brayman on in a couple of weeks talking about collaboration initiatives. And a lot of Sedona people have been appearing on these shows. The topic we're covering, I did want to mention, you and Judge Shinlin, who's going to be on tomorrow's show, had wrote an article that appeared in the Cardoso Law Review called Special Masters and eDiscovery, the intersection of two recent revisions to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. It's volume 30, colon 2. It's the site, page 347. I've forgotten all my blue booking. But anyway, it's a very nice article. And we're going to talk generally about it, although I must say, Jonathan, you made me feel like a second-year associate again. We talked about the podcast last night. I got the 59-page article. I've almost finished it, and now here we go.
Well, fortunately, you don't have to read the entire thing to get the gist of what we're talking about here. In terms of special masters, I think maybe we could level set for our audience that special master is a specific term in the rules of civil procedure on the federal level, and there are state equivalents. It's Rule 53, and before 2003, it was a somewhat antiquated rule in the sense that masters were another way in which you could have issues tried by persons. You could either do a magistrate sitting as a master, or you could appoint someone to be a master to help resolve issues of dispute. Now, what had happened in practice was courts found that they could use special masters in discovery contexts and have them help, especially in complex litigation. Although the rule didn't quite fit that situation, judges made it fit. So when we got to 2003, the Rules Advisory Committee had thought about the actual practice and basically conformed the rule to that practice, and there are now explicit provisions in here that allow for courts to appoint special masters in cases. It used to be there was a high standard or threshold. The 2003 amendments made it a little bit easier, provided that the court did the right things in terms of the appointment order. The rule also is clarified to state that the appointment order had to be more specific. It couldn't just be general. Specific about what the special master's duties were and how the special master, he or she, was supposed to carry out those duties. And, of course, then recognizing that the master had to make written reports and recommendations to the court that ultimately the court has to adopt or reject in whole or in part.
Well, why in electronic discovery generally might you want to have a special master?
Well, that's a great question. And obviously, Judge Shindlin and I, when we put this together, we kind of melded those 2003 changes that resulted in the modern Rule 53 with the 2006 changes to the civil rules that dealt with electronic discovery. And I can't say it's like peanut butter and chocolate together, but in some ways there's a great synergy between the two rules, because in the area of e-discovery, whether it's complex litigation or not, there are some of these disputes where, depending on the role and the person you have as a special master, you could greatly facilitate the process. Or if it's a hotly disputed matter and there are some real tough, knotty issues, a special master can spend the time that a district court judge or a magistrate judge may not be able to, depending on the district and the caseload, to sort through the parties' contentions and narrow the issues and issue a written report and recommendation that can really guide both the parties and the court and make the process more efficient. And that's, you know, in a nutshell, why you'd want to consider a special master in the e-discovery context, because you can, A, make it more efficient in terms of time. If the district court or magistrate judges won't have enough time to devote to an issue, and it's an important issue to deal with to make the litigation go forward, to get through discovery and on to trial. And then there's also an efficiency point. If the special master has the time and the expertise to deal with these issues, more often than not, you might be able to get rulings more quickly. And those rulings hopefully would conform to not only where the law is, but setting the parties' expectations. And when you have better grounding as far as what the expectations are for rulings in a case, then the parties can self-regulate themselves to conform to that, and they have a better sense of where the case is going, which leads to greater efficiency throughout the litigation process.
Where do you see sort of the tensions arise where you know a special master might be appropriate? I mean, searching, preservation, I mean, privilege. I mean, where are sort of the disputes that someone, you know, judge maybe, or the parties throw up their arms and say, we need a special master?
There are a couple of different ones I can think of off the top of my head. The first could be the traditional one, whether or not it's e-discovery, but certainly has kind of expanded in the world of the volumes of e-discovery, and that is dealing with privilege contentions and being able to help the parties work through ways in which, either through traditional privilege logs and adjudicating privilege logs, or through doing some creative approaches to how you assert privilege and defend privilege, helping the parties resolve that so that your district court judge isn't sitting there with a privilege log of 10,000 entries that go on for 200,000 pages. And you can ask any of the judges on your program what happens when they get those logs. A special master can help cut through that and help the parties figure out better ways to assert it, and then the only challenge what really might matter in a case. Another example could be search and retrieval, helping the parties understand not simple keywords, but more complex. We've got maybe three or four different lists that you're going to concatenate, and they have anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000 different terms, and if the parties are really disputing how to do it, a special master can help broker kind of the ultimate agreement on how it's going to work. Or if there are disputes on form of production, or if there are disputes with respect to reasonable accessibility, you can have the special master, and either he or she has the technical expertise, there has access to people who have technical expertise under his or her direction, then you can have them make rulings or issue reports and recommendations, more technically, that will help the court understand the issue faster and better, and then again, giving that direction to the party so that the rules, so to speak, are set. And again, with settled expectation comes a better sense of the proportionality and how you deal with the litigation and what the true costs are going to be. So, those are a couple of examples, Carl, of where a special master can provide assistance. There's another realm, and that is where the court may be investigating what I'd call the country and Western, somebody done somebody wrong song. Mm-hmm. And that means that if there needs to be the equivalent of an internal investigation, was there information lost? Was the conduct of a party such that a sanction should be issued because they're reckless or maybe intentional in terms of failing to preserve or deliberately destroying information? A special master can have that focus, the same as an internal investigator, to look at the evidence and the issues, to take deposition testimony if necessary, to review documents, and then issue reports and recommendations about the culpability and also the harm that was occasioned by whatever the activities of the parties were. So in that situation, the special master can really serve almost that fact-finding role that was in the original Rule 53, but in any event, that could be a very significant role, again, where the magistrate judge or district court judge has so many other things on their plate that understandably they couldn't do the same level of detail and inspection and inquiry that a special master could.
Well, how do you go out and hire a special master? Is there a yellow pages category that you go find, or where do you find these people?
Well, there isn't a yellow pages per se. I think there are a couple of folks across the country that have either referenced some people they know as special masters, or they are seen in some of the cases out there. Obviously, this is an area where I've been involved. I know Craig Ball is another name that comes right to my mind, but there are organizations such as the CPR group that they're looking at ways in which to train people. And then, basically, though, it's judges who get to know lawyers who are involved in this area, and lawyers they think can also, help mediate disputes to extend that's the facilitative role, or that they could rule upon issues with credibility and substance. And so I think it's really a matter of people who have been leaders in the field get to be known, and then people will kind of reach out to them. In actual practice, it's the judges who will sit down with the parties and say, okay, I think we've got a dispute here that rises to a level of significance or importance or complexity that bringing someone else in is going to help us in this situation. Then they'll ask for names from the parties, and people will scratch off names on each side, and then they ultimately arrange for the person to come in. They maybe interview them on the phone, and then the court appoints them under Rule 53 after they've done the requisite screening for conflicts and any disqualification that might exist under the statute. So that's really the process that happens. There is no accreditation board. There is no one repository that the federal courts keep or anyone else keeps that says this is the list of approved special masters. That doesn't exist. So it's more of an environment where people just know other people who have either done it or are experts or have some special expertise. Now, mind you, I should note here that there are some special masters are acting almost like court-appointed experts on the evidence rules, but they might be appointed under Rule 53. And this is where there might be a highly technical issue that the parties need to get through, either in terms of production or something else, where the court says, well, we're going to appoint this highly technical person as a special master to help the parties work through it. And that may not even be a lawyer who's serving that role, but that's another thing the courts retain some some authority to do. And an example of that would be maybe in an intellectual property case that's dealing with continued use of some technology or where the technology resides within the organization to sequester it. The technical expertise that someone could bring to bear on that might be something that will be very beneficial to the parties to get a ruling and direction on how to handle that data going forward. So, you know, that's kind of another avenue that people might be looking for someone with highly specific technical expertise to come in and be a special master for that kind of a role.
So the authority a special master might have in a case could vary. I mean, they could be a complex babysitter all the way to being the adjudicator of facts for a limited role. Is that true?
That's right. There's a wide discretion that the special master can have in a given case. And the best practice for judges in accordance with Rule 53 is to make sure that the appointment order specifies the duties that the master will have. And that appointment order will also go into some of the details as far as when and how you X nature of how the record is going to be compiled, time limits on how things are going to be done within the matter, and then how the reports and recommendations are going to be filed with the court. So there's a lot of just procedural stuff that gets built in, but the most important is specifying what the duties and authorities will be for that special master. Now, one thing, of course, to make clear here is that everything does have to go back up to a district court Article III judge under the federal system. And the special master is not a world unto him or herself.
And I remember I saw some opinions on that where special masters sometimes lost track of their instructions and would go beyond what they were asked to do.
Oh, that's right. So a special master in fulfilling her or his role needs to understand what that appointment authority is. And, you know, it can change in the case if there's a issues 1 through 4 and it turns out that issue 5 and 6 comes up, the court can make a subsequent referral of those issues to the special master. But again, best practice, it should be in an order making a specific referral.
One of the issues you hear at e-discovery conferences nationally is a concern about judges not being up to speed, in addition to lawyers not being up to speed in this area. And is a special master a vehicle for a judge to just punt if they feel they don't have the knowledge in depth to handle the case?
Well, my experience is that judges aren't really ones to punt. What they'll do is they'll look at the issues before them and they'll turn to a special master if they really needed to, you know, to use the football analogy. They're the person that's going to be in the best position to run a particular play. Whether that be a pass, a punt, or a run, they've said that because of the nature of the case, either the complexity or the issues involved or the time frame and how it needs to be resolved, this is a good case for a special master to get involved in. So it's not a matter of the court running away from an issue they don't want to deal with. It's a matter of a court saying that in accordance with Rule 1, which is where everything goes back to for the just, speedy, and inexpensive resolution of matters, that you look for and you appoint someone that can help assist the court and the parties get through the dispute either facilitatively or with an adjudication that then goes up the report and recommendation. But it's those circumstances where the court determines that a special master will help that they turn to the special master. Special master comes in and does her or his job. Is it true that some judges will find comfort that people will have a greater level of expertise in dealing with this? That's probably true, just like special masters dealing with any other issue that might be sent to them, or when it's a court-appointed expert on, for example, technical issues, they'll find comfort in that through that expertise. But in all cases that I've seen, and what I would expect under the practice under Rule 53, is that courts remain very engaged in this, because in the end, as an Article III judge, it comes back to them. So you can't really punt, because the ball always comes back to the huddle, and it's going to be handed to the quarterback, who's the Article III judge. So I don't really see it as much as a punt as a referral to get the advantage of someone's time and expertise to either help resolve matters or at least put an adjudication forward or proposed adjudication that then the parties in the court can have a much better framework to work with.
Good offensive coordinator then.
It might very well be, yes.
Okay. Now, You had noted in the article a trend of some pushback among some courts to appointing special masters despite their growth. What's behind that, do you think?
Well, I think there's in some districts a truly historic view that the Article III judges and the magistrates that have been appointed are really the ones that should be doing this job. That resort to a special master should be truly extraordinary. And in many ways, that was the case law that developed under the old Rule 53. Now, again, 2003, the rules changes, I think, loosened that up. But there's a lot of history to our courts. And for certain districts, they just believe that a magistrate judge or the district judges should be able to handle the issues no matter what. And in a way, this comes back to the punting that people are saying, well, we're not going to punt. And they view that if they had to have a special master, maybe it's a punt. And as I said just a minute ago, I don't think that's really the right analogy. I don't think people are really punting the issue at all. But there are districts where it's just not looked upon favorably to kind of reach outside, whereas in other districts, people say, you know what, this makes a lot of sense, so we're going to do it here. Again, know your jurisdiction, know your judges.
Now, you know, this is a growing trend, it appears. You know, so what are you seeing? Are you seeing any trends going forward or future uses of special masters?
Well, I do believe that you're going to have greater use of special masters in these different areas, whether it's helping to facilitate the process. You look at things like the Sedona Cooperation Proclamation and what it really means to have a more transparent, less adversarial discovery system. You could see that having a special master that can help work that process and be available to the parties could be a tremendous benefit to the system as a whole. And since I think we're kind of moving towards that, even look at the American College of Trial Lawyers report that came out with the University of Denver Institute, Institute for Advancement of Legal Studies this past week. Even though they're advocating a great reduction in the amount of discovery, there's still a number of citations to Sedona and kind of a recognition about the fact that something's got to be done about discovery. Well, if you can bring in someone who helps facilitate this, and let's face it, discovery is electronic discovery. It's synonymous now. If you can have a special master who helps facilitate agreements or resolve issues quickly at the beginning of a case, that can really help the process and get, again, to the merits of the case more quickly and more efficiently for everyone, which is going to be a true benefit. So, you know, I think there's a trend. I think that in the complex cases, there's just a benefit that judges see to having someone else that can help with the discovery rulings. In terms of the inquisitive role, if you have, you know, some sort of sanctions dispute, spoliation dispute, judges can see the benefit for having someone that knows the ropes in this area. And I think you're going to see an increase in that as well. And that's really not a bad thing, because those folks that are appointed can help cut to the chase much more quickly. And just, you know, cases where there isn't really a serious ground for sanctions or a serious ground for any spoliation inquiry, they can be cut off more quickly. And then with respect to the ones that are more serious, a more in-depth examination can be undertaken. And they'll get to the truth of the matter. And, you know, a sound report and recommendation can come out, and then the judge can rule upon it after hearing objections of the parties. So I see the trends in each of those areas kind of moving towards the likelihood you'll have more masters appointed. And even in the smaller cases, I think that might be true to just help cut off the dispute. So it's not necessarily going to be a huge cost driver in cases to have a person appointed, although keep in mind, the parties usually split the cost, or someone's ending up paying for this person, unlike the judiciary where, you know, the judges are paid by the federal government. So there is that cost issue that does come up, as to which it's not necessarily insignificant in a large manner.
But still, it seems like it could be a cut to the chase, cost containment issue, instead of being more adversarial.
It could be, depending on what the appointment order is and what the referral is. I mean, because you get a very broad referral to ask a special master to do a lot of things, and it could be a very expensive proposition. If it's just a really facilitative role that helps them get through the first part from the 26F conference to, you know, a full, a decent report under Rule 16 in the conference with the court, that could be a much less expensive proposition. In both cases, though, the special master is fulfilling an important role as to which value comes from that appointment.
You know, I was just thinking about this, and I was going to ask you, do you see this maybe being like a mediation trend occurring with agreeing on a special master up front? But that almost puts the cart in front of the horse. I mean, e-discovery is a is a process, there's an underlying dispute, which might make it more challenging to carve out discovery without a judge getting involved. I mean, do you think there's a way that if parties really are collaborating, they might agree to special masters up front, or is this top down?
Carl, it's hard to say. I think in some cases they really realize that might be a good thing to reach out to each other and say, let's get a special master in here. In others, it's the courts in a certain district have said, you know, this is a better way for us to deal with it because the parties don't know what they're even dealing with yet. So there's still a great gulf between certain lawyers and law firms and parties with respect to how much they even understand about this themselves. But sophisticated consumers, if you have them all around the table on both sides of the V in a lawsuit, they may well say, you know what, we should get someone in here to help us cut through this quicker. And in other cases, again, it's going to be the judges. I've seen this circus before. I'm not going to, you know, spend my time watching the car wrecks. I need to get someone in here who can help direct the traffic and make sure the parties do the right thing. The bigger trend, and one that remains to be seen, is whether things like the Sedona Cooperation Proclamation in efforts to kind of reduce the adversarial nature of discovery, whether those really take a lot of traction, because that could be a tremendous boon to having other people come in as either neutrals. It's almost like mediation, as you said, for discovery, but to help people cut through it more quickly rather than having endless disputes and motion papers filed ad infinitum.
Well, this has been really very helpful and informative, and I wanted to mention three cases that were in your article if people don't access the article, which gave orders basically on how special masters can be appointed and their scope. Ho Hyder v. United Parcel Service, Inc., In Re Sirocal Products Liability Litigation, and the third one is Medtronic Sophomore Danik Inc. v. Mickelson. My transcriber is going to hate me. But anyway, I appreciate your time on this. I think this has been helpful, and hopefully we can have you on more podcasts.
No problem, Carl. Happy to be here. I hope this is of value for all the folks who are listening in on this. And if you want to view the Law Review article itself, I'm sure Carl will provide a link, or you can go to the Cardozo Law Review website itself, and it's posted there.
Great.
Thanks again, everyone, and have a great day.
Thank you.